So welcome. This course is called Decoding the Talmud. It is quite different than previous JLI, Jewish Learning Institute courses we have been teaching. Well, actually, as a matter of fact, I can safely say that every course is different from every other course. This course is about the Talmud. Probably every Jew knows the word Talmud, and I can probably assume that if asked, most of Jews will not be able to articulate what Talmud exactly is. They will tell you it's something Jewish, it's something has to do with the Jewish law, and it's a famous book. What is it exactly? We're going to find out. And we will start with introductory video about Talmud.
March 3rd, 1240, was a Shabbat. But for the harassed Jews of medieval France, numbering as many as 100,000 souls, it was not to be a day of rest, but of unprecedented unrest. They were praying in the synagogues when the raid began. In cities and towns throughout the kingdom, agents of King Louis IX of France burst through the doors of Jewish houses of prayer and seized thousands of hapless prisoners. All the detainees were transported to Paris, where they were held in convents under strict guard to await their trial on accusations of grave crimes. For 3 long months, they languished in captivity until their collective trial began. Meanwhile, the Jews of the kingdom gathered continuously to storm the heavens on their behalf with fasting and prayer. 4 of the greatest luminaries of the French Jewish community, led by the highly respected Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, served as the prisoners' legal defense. Following the trial, the judges continued to debate the case for another 2 years, while European Jewry held its breath. Finally, in June of 1242, 24 wagons of tightly packed convicts rolled into Place de Grève, causing the Jews of France to emit a collective groan of horror. Place de Grève was a public square along the banks of the Seine River, notorious as the historic site of public executions, hangings, beheadings, and burnings at the stake. Throngs of Parisians lined the streets to enjoy the spectacle, while those of the Jewish faith remained hidden, terrified to venture from their homes. The prisoners had been found guilty and had been sentenced to extermination through public burning. The evil verdict was carried out with glee. But as they were consigned to the flames, there were no cries of agony or despair, nor was there a smell of burning flesh, because the prisoners were not people. They were books, thousands upon thousands of handwritten scrolls and codices, every copy of the Talmud that the king's agents could find in France, almost all of which had been sheltered in the nation's synagogues, had been arrested, put on trial, and condemned to public burning. The Jewish tradition was consigned to the fire that day, and as angry flames roared at their ancient wisdom, as their teachings rose as ash, and an inferno ingested their spiritual treasures, the Jewish communities of France were singed with grief and flung into mourning for their executed pages, for their martyred beliefs.
The story described in the video we just watched, unfortunately, is not an isolated incident. Throughout our Jewish history, we have always experienced anti-Semitism, and by now, probably nobody is going to be doubting that. But the question comes, why was this anti-Semitism aimed not only at us as people, not only at us as Jews, but also at our books? What do books have to do with anything? The answer is because anti-Semites have always known that we Jews are around because of these books. Specifically, the books of Talmud, which is the fundamental work of the Oral Torah. And what Oral Torah is specifically, we're going to be talking in a minute. You see, when we Jews had our temple in Jerusalem, this temple was the center of the Jewish life. And this temple was offering us everything we needed for our spiritual support and for us to survive as Jews. We had the first temple. Then we briefly had a period for 70 years when we did not have a temple. This was our Babylonian exile. We returned to the land of Israel and we had another several centuries with the second temple. When the second temple was about to be destroyed, the Jewish sages realized that soon Jews are about to be dispersed throughout the planet. And soon we will not have this edifice of Jewish life that gives us this foundation, this support, this nurturing. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was in Jerusalem when it was under siege by the Romans, and he knew that the temple is about to be destroyed, he managed to escape the besieged city and make his way to Vespasianus, the Roman emperor. And he already knew that the temple is going to be destroyed. Vespasianus was set on this goal. He asked Vespasianus to please allow him to establish a Jewish academy in the city of Yavna, where he would continue teaching the Torah. And Vespasianus agreed. Vespasianus wanted to destroy the brick and mortar foundation of the Jewish nation. He didn't realize that the Jews will take this temple with them where they go. They now have a portable temple. They now have a portable foundation of their Jewish life. And this foundation of Jewish life was primarily, specifically, the teaching of Talmud. And that's why future anti-Semites have learned from Vespasianus's quote-unquote mistake. Destroying their temple is not enough. We need to destroy their portable temple. We need to destroy the edifice of their life that they have with them, in their houses, on the bookshelf of every Jewish home, in synagogues, and in yeshivas. And this is why, throughout our history, anti-Semites wanted to destroy us by destroying our religion, by destroying our teachings. And the story that we saw in this video is describing how in the 13th century, King Louis IX wanted to burn every book of Talmud that was found in his empire. But and by the way, we probably know that on the day of Tisha B'Av, 9th of Av, we recite Kinnot, which are the lamentations, texts that describe sad occurrences throughout our history. We obviously speak about the destruction of the temple, because this is what the main reason for 9th of Av is. But besides for that, we read about other tragedies. And Rabbi Meir Maharam of Rothenburg, was present right there when these volumes of Talmud were burned. He wrote a poem describing his agony, his pain. And this poem is included in the Kinnot of Tisha B'Av, the Lamentations that we read on the 9th of Av. Why is it? Because on 9th of Av we are mourning the destruction of the physical temple and subsequent events that were trying to destroy our portable temple as well, trying to take away the Torah away from us. Just to put things in context, Germany and France were then the edifice of Torah learning for Ashkenazic Jews. We know that the Jewish world was split on Sephardic and Ashkenazic communities. It was primarily because some Jews were under the rule of the Christians, and some Jews were under the rule of the Muslims, and communication between these areas was sometimes impossible, sometimes possible, but dangerous. And that's why the Jews who were in Christian countries had to find their own rabbis who they would go to for teachings. And the Jews in Sephardic countries, in Muslim countries, had to find their own rabbis to go to for guidance. That's how the separation between Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews came about. And Germany and France were the center of the Jewish communities. That's where the famous Rashi lived. This is where Maharam of Rothenburg lived, where that we just said. This is where so many other famous Jewish rabbis lived at that time. And when they were trying to take away Talmud from Jews in those communities, they were trying to destroy the Torah learning throughout the entire Ashkenazic Jewish world. And we know now that Jews have survived because we had the Talmud. Now, what is Talmud? Let's see. Talmud, it's a book of debates, as you probably know. Over 60 volumes of debates on various topics. And in yeshivas, when Jewish students learn for 10 hours a day, 7 out of these 10 hours are dedicated to the study of Talmud. That's what they do. If you ever walk into yeshiva, you will not realize that you are in some academic environment. When you walk into a place where people study, you think it's going to be quiet because people need to concentrate. You imagine a library where people come, take books, look up information they need. When my son comes home from yeshiva, every time he comes for a vacation, you meet him here whenever he's here for Shabbos, he's hoarse. Why? Because guys in yeshiva yell at each other. The entire study hall, sometimes tens, sometimes hundreds of students, is broken up into pairs, what's called in Aramaic, chevruta. Chevruta literally means a partner, a study partner. And one reads, explains it, the other one is trying to prove him wrong. That's where the Jewish idea of always contradicting whatever you are told is coming from. And they're trying to convince each other, and they argue. Talmud has created its own culture and its own language. The Talmud is not written in Hebrew, as you know. It's written in Aramaic. But even the Aramaic of Talmud is full of its own terminology, its own words that I'm sure people back then, when Aramaic was a spoken language, when they spoke Aramaic at home, did not use. Talmud has its own tone of voice that you read Talmud with. And this has become the Jewish traditional way how we learn. And if you ever hear a person talking like this is because he is repeating how he was learning in yeshiva. And as you see now, when I'm talking to you, I'm making this movement with my finger. I cannot help it because this is also a Jewish move that only you can see whenever somebody is studying Talmud. Talmud has its own culture, its own language, its own melody, its own movements. And I can promise you that all of your great-grandparents, when they would come home at night, what would they study at home? They would not read the news. They would not check New York Times. They would not watch CNN. They were studying the Talmud. Because this is what the entire Jewish life was focusing on. The Talmud was the foundation of everything Jews need to know about their lives. So our course will be talking about Talmud, and this class is going to be introduction. I'm going to be setting the background of what Talmud is all about. The second class is going to be about the first part of Talmud, which is Mishnah. The following three classes afterwards are going to be about the second part, a much larger part of Talmud, which is Gemara. Mishnah is the work that was written in the second century by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and it was compiled from the sayings and teachings of about 120 rabbis that preceded Rabbi Yehuda Nasi or lived at the same time with him. Mishnah is written in Hebrew, and it is an incredibly organized work. The entire Mishnah is broken up into six volumes. Each volume is dedicated to a specific topic, and they talk only about this topic, nothing else. There's no sidetracking in Mishnah. The language of Mishnah is extremely precise. People analyze every little word of Mishnah. And Mishnah is written in Hebrew, which is the holy tongue. And Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who compiled the Mishnah, he was known for having great command of Hebrew language. And his language was known as the golden standard of Hebrew language. Everything he wrote was extremely precise. Now, after Mishnah was concluded, the next generations of rabbis were already compiling Gemara, the second part. If you open any page of Talmud, you will see a paragraph of Mishnah, and then pages and pages and pages of Gemara, which is explaining Mishnah. Gemara is written in Aramaic, not in Hebrew. And if I told you that Mishnah is an extremely organized work, Gemara is the furthest from being organized. The rabbis are discussing a specific law, and they have somebody mention that the ruling here is this way. Why? Because in different places, similar question regarding a different issue, and the ruling is that way over there, and that's why the ruling should be this way here also. Oh, you mentioned that issue. Let's figure out what was going on in that issue. What was going on with that question? We are getting completely sidetracked by discussing that topic. Why? Because we need to figure out whether that ruling was actually this way or not this way, where this rabbi is correctly applying that ruling to hear. And we are talking about a completely different issue. Now, while we're discussing that different issue, a rabbi is mentioning a story that proves one way or another. Once we mention the story, now we need to figure out if this story was correct or not. Maybe his interpretation of story is not entirely accurate. And we are talking about this story and five other stories because of which we can clarify that story. And once we are talking all of those stories, we have to mention all the laws which are pertaining to all of those stories. By the time you come back to the original question, you already have to flip a few pages to remember what you are talking about. Why is Talmud written like this? I will tell you why. Mishnah could be looked at as an academic work. You study the law. When you open Mishnah, this is what you do. Gemara is a practical work. It's not an academic work. Whenever I go about my life, I need to understand something. How does it usually happen? I learn new things on the foundation of the previous things which I have in my knowledge, in my knowledge base. Those things might not be exactly the same in all respects. I might be able to understand something in my relationship with my friends from something I realized earlier in my relationship with my son. I might be able to understand something in business based on what I heard as a kid from my teacher. And our minds always work because we are connecting different events and different understandings and different situations. This is how our minds really work. Because Talmud is a practical book, that's why Gemara specifically is working this way, because it connects different events in our lives. It shows us also that the Torah is encompassing all areas of our lives. There's no such a thing as I am a Jew in this respect, but I'm not a Jew here. I am applying Torah in these areas, but I'm not applying Torah in these areas. I'll just bring you an example. We here in America, we had elections recently. You heard about it? Yeah? You heard? Like, we have a new president now. You're all aware, right? I'm just making sure. Okay, so political debates on everybody's mind. Everybody is arguing, fighting, you name it. People are so worked up. I remember recently, people were discussing some political issue, one of the hot button issues, and they turned to me and they asked me, what do I think about it? And I, without even thinking much about how and why I'm saying it, I'm just saying, yeah, the Torah's view on this issue is so and so, such and such. And they both looked at me and they said, oh, we didn't realize that the Torah has something to say about it. Not only that, as Jews never even thought that maybe we should consult the Torah and see what the Torah says about it. Because unfortunately, very often people in their mind have the areas that their Jewish awareness is present, and then there are other areas where, I don't know, why does Torah have to be mixed in over here? What does it have to do with anything Jewish? People didn't realize that, you know, Torah has something to say about popular political questions. It didn't even occur to them. So Talmud is specifically intertwining every issue of life to show that, first of all, the Torah is relating to every area of our existence, and secondly, because all of this is intertwined. Whenever, by the way, if you study Talmud, you will see, whenever rabbis say that, in my view, the ruling here should be in this and this way, it's not because this rabbi just woke up this morning, scratched his head and said, oh, I think it's this way. No. It is because this rabbi has a specific way of thinking, which is followed in everything what he says. And by the way, the Lubavitcher Rebbe spent a lot of time emphasizing precisely that. That whenever there is a ruling of a specific rabbi in Talmud, it is because of his precise approach. And we can find this approach, we can find a way of thinking in every other ruling that he is making. So his ruling in the area of Sabbath observance has to be consistent with his ruling with regards to monetary disputes with people and with regards to how to observe Pesach and with regards to what to do if husband and wife got in a fight. All of this is intertwined, and that's why Talmud is built the way it's built. And the sixth class will be specifically focusing on how Talmud is applicable to our daily lives today. These are the six classes that we are going to be hosting here during this series, Decoding the Talmud. The makeup of Talmud is such that approximately three quarters of Talmud are focusing on discussing the Jewish law, Jewish observance, the details of Jewish observance. One third of Talmud is discussing other issues. That part, the smaller part, is called Agadeta, which is in Aramaic for telling, relaying, telling a story. The legal part or legalistic part of Talmud is called Halakha, which we loosely translate as the Jewish law. Literally, it's translated as a path of walking. Lalechet is to walk. Holech means he is walking. Halacha means a path to walk on, the way of walking. And the Jewish law is discussing what we need to do whenever we have a question, what should be done. The part of Agadata is discussing Jewish mystical teachings, ethical norms, very often has Jewish wisdom, stories, and history lessons. It has sometimes medical advice. It has some other good advice for people's life, which is not relating to Jewish law specifically. This is Agadata. So, just few facts that we need to know about the Talmud. Like I already said, Talmud has two parts, Mishnah and Gemara, and Mishnah was completed by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi in the second century of Common Era. And you might think that when you read this work, when you read Mishnah, you might think that he got all the rabbis together, they were all sitting in my room, and they were discussing the laws, and he's saying, this rabbi said this, that rabbi said that. It was not the case. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi compiled opinions of many different rabbis who very often haven't seen each other because they lived in different generations or maybe in different areas. The debates of Mishnah are compiled right on paper because Rabbi Yehuda Nasi said that this rabbi says this about this law and that rabbi says that. And then comes Gemara, which was completed three centuries later by Ravina and Ravashi, and they again did the same thing. In Talmud, you will see that Rabbi so-and-so says this and Rabbi so-and-so says that. These rabbis probably didn't see each other. Ravina and Ravashi compiled opinions of these rabbis about every issue that they can collect, and then wrote what each rabbi says, and then, very often, not even the rabbis themselves, but their students, where they would meet each other. They would debate the law, and each rabbi had his supporting arguments attached to his assertions. And this is how Talmud came about. Talmud has, I said Mishnah has 6 volumes. Talmud has 63 volumes. And the topics of these volumes span about every area of life. For reference, I said that Mishnah has 120 rabbis who are brought down there. They're called Tanaim, the sages of Mishnah. Talmud has 800 rabbis. So you can realize that Ravina and Rav Ashi, who have put together this monumental work, have analyzed the opinions of far more than 800 rabbis. We also have writings that that were not included in Mishnah and Gemara. We have, for example, Tasefta. Tasefta, this was a work of rabbis that was analyzed, and they decided not to include it in Mishnah. Why? Because it was repetitive, because somebody else already voiced this opinion. Not every opinion was written, not every statement was written. So Ravina and Rav Ashi similarly had to analyze many, many rabbis, I'm sure more than 800, and they brought down the opinions of these 800 rabbis in an organized fashion where it seems like they're actually talking to each other. Now, we know that we have not one Talmud, but two Talmuds. We have the Babylonian Talmud and we have the Jerusalem Talmud. And where was Babylonian Talmud written? Not in Babylonia. Where was Jerusalem Talmud written? Not in Jerusalem. The Jerusalem Talmud was written in the northern Israel, near the city of Tiberias. It was called Jerusalem Talmud because Jerusalem was the capital of Israel. And Jews there, by that time, they were already mostly expelled from Jerusalem. And the rabbis wanted to name their Talmud after Jerusalem because they still saw it as their capital. Babylonian Talmud was written in the Babylonian Empire, but not in the city of Babylonia. The Talmud was written in Pompundiso, which was a Jewish suburb of Babylonia. That was the Pikesville of Babylonian Empire. It had its own Park Heights Avenue, I promise you. Like, yeah, it was there. Interestingly enough, that not every one of 63 tractates of Talmud has Gemara in it. Some of them have only Mishnah. Why? Because some of the tractates were so well explained in Mishnah that Ravina and Rav Ashi, who were putting Gemara together, said, you know what? We don't need discussions of rabbis about it. These are usually the small tractates, which I guess were about more of less complex issues, put it this way. By the way, if you ever hear word the Talmud, it usually refers to Babylonian Talmud, because that's the main Talmud that is mostly learned in yeshivas. Jerusalem Talmud is usually learned once you graduate from studying Babylonian Talmud, you go to Jerusalem Talmud. It is learning of a different level, much more aloof spiritually than Babylonian Talmud. How many pages does Babylonian Talmud have? Between 63 volumes, there are 2,711 pages, but pages are double-sided. It's really folios. 2,711 folios, and today, all around the world, the editions of Talmud are standardized. Whenever we make a reference about something written in Talmud, we don't use chapter or subchapter, we use tractate, and the page of this tractate, folio, which is a double-sided page, and then we say A or B, Aleph or Bet, first side or second side. Why? Because the editions of Talmud are standardized, and everywhere around the world, Jews have Talmuds with the same pages. Originally, they were a little bit different, one word here, one word there on each page, but today everybody uses what's called the Vilna Shas, the print of Vilna, Vilnius, and that's the standard edition. It was printed by the printing shop of the Rom family, R-O-M, I personally, when I was working in Australia, I personally met a great grandson of that family that printed the Shas. His mother's maiden name was Rom, R-O-M. So these are the basic facts that we need to know about Talmud and which areas of law does Talmud cover. The answer is every area of law. When we think about law, we usually think about laws that are given to us to prevent harm, to settle disputes between people, to define societal obligations, to regulate communities. Well, the Talmud has all that, but besides for that, it speaks about our religious law. What am I supposed to do for Jewish rituals? What am I supposed to do in my personal life with things that don't affect others? There is a famous saying that here in America, everybody says, we live in a free country, right? I can do whatever I want as long as it doesn't harm others. Well, it's not the Jewish perspective. We believe that even if I'm in a closed room and nobody else knows what I'm doing, my behavior still needs to be regulated. And that's exactly what the Talmud is teaching. What am I supposed to do? It speaks about Jewish calendar, Jewish holidays. It speaks about agricultural practices. They are, the laws are covering also the rituals of service in the temple and laws of ritual purity and impurity, which are the most complicated laws of the Talmud. Now, Talmud, as I mentioned before, is the fundamental work of the oral Torah. What is oral Torah? People ask me, what is oral Torah? I tell them, here's a book of oral Torah. And people look at me funny. It's oral. How could you give a book of oral Torah? Rabbi, make up your mind. Rabbis have a hard time making up their mind, don't you know? So this is why we have something which is called the written Torah and oral Torah. Okay? Imagine you are students in a class, in school. We are all in the same class in school. And you all are straight A students. And you keep meticulous notes. You're like goody-goodies. Like a typical Jewish student, like this book nerd with big glasses and plays violin, I'm sure. You know, so you are that, okay? And I am this no good Nick. I am this naughty kid that cuts every class, and even when I'm there, I am not even listening. I am there just to make sure that the teacher will mark me that I'm in attendance. And then suddenly, I realize that there's a big test coming up. There's a final exam, and I have no clue what this exam is even going to be on. I am in panic calling you. You are such a good friend of mine. Please, can I please borrow your notes? I need to prepare for tomorrow's test. You are a good friend. You say, sure, come. Take my notes. You don't need them. You already prepared. You already know everything from listening to the teacher and doing your homework. I come home with your notes. Open them up. And now I want to ask you a question. Will I be able to prepare for the test using your notes? The answer is no. I can promise you that the minute after I come home and open your notes, I will be calling you. What does this word mean? What's this abbreviation here? Why are you writing this here? This line doesn't flow after this line. You have your own abbreviations there. It's your notes. You have your own abbreviations. You know why you wrote. No student ever writes down every single word he hears from the teacher. It's impossible. You write your own notes, your own abbreviations. Then there are some things which you know already because they were mentioned before. You skip them, but they're needed for the flow of the class. Yeah, you know that they're needed for the flow of the class, and you know them, that's why you don't mention them. But if I read your notes, I won't know that. Then you have your own asterisk over there. Then you have your own combination of words which only you know. And I'm reading all this, I'm like, I have no clue what's flying. So I will need your explanations. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, went up to Mount Sinai and he heard lectures from God for 40 days and 40 nights. And he was a good student. And he was taking notes. He came down from Mount Sinai telling Jews, hey, guys, God gave me a lot of information. I made sure to write it all down. Here are the notes. Jews open the notes, and what do? They do the same thing what I would do after reading your notes from your class. They run back to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Moses. Excuse me? What does this mean? Why'd you write this here? What is this here? And Moshe had to explain to the Jews why he wrote what he wrote. And he did it orally. That's why we have written Torah. The written Torah is what we received from Moses in writing. And then we have oral Torah, what we received from Moses orally. It was later written down. And Talmud is exactly that. But we received it orally. So, this is the difference between the written Torah, which is the first step of this staircase, this ladder that we have on the screen, and the second, which is received information. We received it. Just like the five books of Moses, we received from Moses, that's why they're called five books of Moses. We received the oral Torah also from Moses, but we received it orally. Now, this is only one part of the oral Torah. Oral Torah has three parts. First is what is received. In Hebrew terminology, in Talmudic terminology, it's called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. There are things which were not written in the five books of Moses, but we know this is the law. That's how we know that when the Torah says eye for an eye, it does not literally mean you need to punch out a guy's eye if he hurt someone's eye. Moshe said, I'm writing down eye for an eye, but it means monetary compensation. Moshe said it orally. Moshe said, I'm writing, do not cook a calf in its mother's milk. It means don't eat generally meat and milk together. Moshe said it. Why did he write it this way, not that way? He also explained, and that's explained in Talmud. Why did it have to be written this way? But it's all oral explanation. That's what's called received, the received part of oral Torah. Then there's another part of oral Torah. We know that the Torah is conveying everything it can in the shortest possible manner. Which means what? Which means that if there are things that we can derive from other things which are written, Torah will just omit them. The Torah will skip them. You figure it out yourself. So, the Torah has 13 principles of deriving information from the written Torah. And these 13 principles are known to everybody. They are actually placed in the Siddur right before our morning services. Right before the synagogue services, we read these 13 principles so every single Jew will know that. There's no some secret code, there's no enigma secret code that only some rabbis know. Every single Jew has this Rosetta Stone. And I'm not referring to the language app. Everybody has Rosetta Stone. Everybody has the way to decode the Torah. These 13 principles are there. Imagine playing Sudoku. every game of Sudoku has squares with numbers, and then it has empty squares. There is only one correct answer for every empty square. There's only one number you could possibly put in an empty square to fill in all the blanks. You need to figure out what this number is. It's up to you. So because the Torah was given to us by God in the most concise way, God said, whatever blanks you could fill in, I'm not going to tell you. God is intentionally leaving these blanks for us to figure out, to fill them in. And this is called the derived part of the oral Torah. So now we have two parts, received and derived. And this is very important. Whenever we read about discussions and arguments of the rabbis, you often see this rabbi says this, that rabbi says that, and we think, well, this rabbi says so because he thinks so. No. Nobody cares what this rabbi thinks, and this rabbi himself did not care what he thinks. It's what the Torah says. This is what he either received from the previous generations, from Moshe, from Moses, or how he sees the only way to fit in these numbers on the Sudoku board. It's not his opinion per se, it's what God says. And that's why, by the way, I mentioned before that the Talmud is often getting sidetracked with other topics. Why is this? Because so often during Talmud discussions, you have this rabbi says that this and this verse is used for this and this law. Sometimes you put this and this number on the Sudoku board. And then you look, well, but if you put this and this number on the Sudoku board, it throws off every other number on this line. What do you do with the other numbers? And this rabbi explains how he fills in the rest of the Sudoku board. Yes, this number is different. That's why this number has to be correct. And this number is different. That's why in my mind, this number has to be different. And this number, and they figure out how it's all fitting in together. This is literally the discussion of Talmud. Because this verse, this rabbi is used for this law. One second, but I thought this verse is already used for something else. No, this rabbi is using this verse for something else. And this, no, but this, but then how does he learn this law? This law he learns from something else, and then something else, and that's why it's so intertwined. Now, there's a third category of oral, of the oral Torah, which is called legislated. Here, you could blame the rabbis. This is where, if you are angry at the rabbis, you could yell at them. Everyone besides for me. Why? Because this is what rabbis legislate. The Torah has given the rabbis the authority to make rulings. Now, these rulings have to be made in very specific cases and for very specific reasons. And there are specific rules how these rulings. Yeah, every ruling has a rule, right? There are rules for rulings. We are not going to be discussing them right now. It's beyond the scope of this class. But rabbis sometimes have the authority to do it. Primarily, it is in order to either help us not violate a law by mistake. For example, the Torah is prohibiting us only to eat meat with milk, meat meaning red meat. But since red meat can often be confused with chicken, the rabbis made a law prohibiting consuming chicken with milk as well. So the biblical law is telling us not to eat meat and milk, red meat, beef, veal. The rabbis said, because very often people refer to chicken as meat, and people eat chicken as meat, and very often it's hard to differentiate them, the rabbis made the ruling that you're not allowed to eat chicken with milk as well. And there are Kabbalistic reasons for that as well, because the same Kabbalistic principle that applies to meat applies to chicken as well. We could talk about it later when we have our classes on Kabbalah, like we had already before. The rabbis made this legislation. So now let's look at an example of these laws, okay? Exodus 12:18. It says, in the first month, On the 14th day of that month, in the evening, you shall eat matzot. The first month means Nisan. That's our first month, right? That was the first month after Jews left Egypt. 14th, the 14th day of that month, in the evening, which means when these days are already over, when the 15th of Nisan is starting, you shall eat matzot. That's all it says. Now, I want to ask you a question. First of all, what exactly is matzah? The Torah doesn't give me a very specific recipe for it. I want to ask you, when it says, eat matzot, how much? If I eat one crumb, is it enough? If I eat, do I need to eat a whole pound? How much do I eat? Then, I want to ask you a question, how do I eat it? Let's figure all of this out. First of all, when we speak about this particular halakha, this specific law, which is in Exodus 12:18, it says, on the evening or after the 14th of Nisan, you should eat matzot. How much of it do you need to eat? There's a general law that we received from Moses. Whenever there's a commandment to eat something, or whenever there's something considered a food, I need to eat at least the weight of an olive of that substance. Olive, not the way we see it in our cans nowadays, because it shrinks. Olive, when it's fresh, when it's growing in a tree, which is bigger. So when the Torah is telling us to eat matzot, it means I need to eat at least an olive size of matzah. In volume, not in size, because if you take a circle and draw with your pencil circle of olive in the matzah, matzah is flat, olive is round, right? So it needs to be it. Now, this is the minimum which is required for fulfilling mitzvah of eating matzah. This is the received part of oral Torah. In other words, the written Torah is only telling me to eat. How much to eat? This is a general rule all across the entire Torah, that if I need to see how much of eating, how much of consumption is called food, it's size of an olive. Okay, next. What is matzah? Well, we all know matzah is flour and water. Great. Nowadays, you could go to a store, you could buy rice flour, you could buy almond flour, you could buy oat flour, spelt flour. You'll go to any health food store, there are flours from things I don't know how to pronounce. So, can I make matzah from spelt? Can I make matzah from almonds? Can I make matzah from rice? It's a good question. So here, we turn to one of the 13 principles that we have in our Siddur, 13 principles of deriving information from the Torah. What is it? It's called Hekesh. Hekesh means whenever there are two laws written next to each other, there's a reason for their proximity. There's a reason for that. I just told you that the Torah conveys everything in the shortest possible manner, right? Well, I've got news for you. If you read the five books of Moses, if you read Chumash, you saw that the mitzvah of eating matzah is written more than once. The shortest possible way. Just read it once. I already read it. Thank you. Why are you writing it again? Because in different places, God is trying to convey different details to us by placing it in a specific place, by putting it in a specific place next to another law or another passage or something else. So it says, right before this law, it says, you shall not have any chametz. Chametz means leavened grain product. You should not have any chametz in your home. And then next verse says, you shall eat matzot, as we read just now. One second. So the rabbis say, Hekesh, the rule of Hekesh means that there is a reason why God placed these two laws next to each other, which means whatever will constitute chametz, the grain, the ingredient that will constitute chametz, the leavened grain, this is what can be used for matzah. Whatever cannot become chametz cannot be used for matzah. If I will take almonds on Pesach, grind them, make flour from them, pour water over them, and let them sit, they might become fermented. I don't know. Do they become? Probably they become fermented. I have no clue. I never tried. But it's not chametz. I'm allowed to do it. The Torah doesn't prohibit me to have any leavened product. I could eat sauerkraut, yogurt. The sauerkraut, kosher for Pesach. The yogurt, kosher for Pesach. Why? It's not grain. So only the things which are prohibited, once they are leavened, that's what can be used for baking matzah. So now we know, old matzah is called matzah. Spelt matzah is called matzah. Why? Because I'm not allowed to have leavened spelt. I'm not allowed to have leavened oat. Wheat, obviously. Rye, obviously. Rice, we Ashkenazic Jews don't eat rice. This is a rabbinic decree for us Ashkenazic Jews. But biblically, you're allowed to eat rice on Pesach. Rice will not become chametz ever. That's why you cannot make matzah out of rice. So now we see this. Now we see that this is a derived part of the Oral Torah. Now let's go to the next question. How do you eat this matzah? Can I eat it jumping, hanging from the ceiling? We have rafters here. Maybe I'll hang on the rafter and eat matzah. Do I need to do it upside down? How do I do it? There is a legislated part of the Torah. The rabbis made a decree that since the Torah is specifically telling us that Pesach is a holiday of our freedom, the Torah is not conveying us any information just because we need to think about something or feel something. Everything the Torah tells us has to lead to action, to a specific action. When the Torah says, love your fellow Jew, love your fellow, it does not mean I could sit in my couch and think how much I love him and then he asks me for a favor and say, get away from here, I'm too tired. But I love you. I'm feeling in my heart the love and that's why I fulfilled the mitzvah. No, I didn't fulfill the mitzvah, even though I feel a lot of love. Now, I hate the guy. I can't stand the guy's guts, but when he asks me to help him, I go and I help him. I fulfill the mitzvah to love your fellow. Why? Because whenever the Torah gives us a mitzvah, it's a call to action. It's not about my feeling. I got news for you. That's what I learned since I grew up from being a kid. Nobody cares about your feelings. Okay? Besides for you. You need to do things for other people. You need to do things for the world. Your feelings are for you, which are great. For the world, you need to do things. So now, if God is telling us that Passover is the holiday of freedom, what does it mean? It has to express itself in my actions somehow. We eat matzah, it says, as a sign of freedom. Oh, one second. So when I eat matzah, I have to express my freedom somehow. So rabbis made a decree that whenever I eat matzah, I have to do the reclining. That's why whenever you eat matzah on Pesach, you are always told to make sure to recline because that's a sign of freedom. A slave is not allowed to sit reclining. He is supposed to be upright. This is the legislated part of the Torah. So now we just discussed the laws of Pesach and we found out that there is the law which is written in the written Torah. Then there is a detail which we know as the part of the received information about this. Then there is a detail that we know as a derived part of oral Torah. Then there is a detail which is the part of legislated oral Torah. We just went through the pretty much entirety of our oral Torah that Talmud is the main book of. Now, here is the most important question. Why do we study Talmud? We said so much about the importance of Talmud, that is the fundamental book of Judaism and Jewish law, of Jewish life, of Jewish culture. Great. But why? Why do we study it? So there are several layers of answers. Number one, because the Jewish law is very complex. And if you want to be a good Jew, you have to learn how to be a good Jew. Judaism is probably the only religion in the world that insists on education. The Talmud says an ignorant person cannot be a pious person. An ignorant Jew cannot be a pious Jew. Ignorant is not referring to my knowledge of biology, math, or chemistry, or modern-day politics. Ignorant is referring to my knowledge of the Torah. Why? Because the Jewish law is very complex. If I need to keep Shabbos, I have to know how to keep Shabbos. What are the 39 types of work which are prohibited on Shabbos? If I want to keep kosher, I have to figure out what does it mean to keep kosher. What am I allowed to do in my kitchen? What I'm not allowed to do in my kitchen? If my meat spoon fell into a pot where I'm making mac and cheese, what am I supposed to be doing now? All of these laws are complex. You have to study. So the first reason why we study Talmud is simply because we need to know the Jewish law. But I want to ask you a question. We have a book called The Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch, that tells us in great detail every single law, without any discussions, without any reasoning, just what to do. So why don't we spend most of our day in yeshiva studying that, study Shulchan Aruch? Shulchan Aruch? Guys in yeshiva spend maybe 1 hour a day studying Shulchan Aruch, an hour and a half max. To become a rabbi, you have to study Shulchan Aruch for a full day, there's a whole program for that. But that's to become a rabbi. But a regular Jew, an ordinary Jew who's not planning to become a rabbi, spends 1 hour, an hour and a half a day studying Shulchan Aruch and 7 hours a day studying Talmud? Crazy! Why do we need to study Talmud? What is the answer? Here are several answers. Number one, the Talmud is not only explaining to me the laws, but also the reasoning for the laws and the hierarchy of these laws. Hierarchy of importance of these laws. We live in a world where we are constantly met with competing values. You should always say the truth, right? Well, what if saying the truth will insult somebody? Should you still say the truth? A Polish woman is hiding Jews from the Nazis during the Holocaust. They knock on her door and ask her, do you have Jews hiding in your house? Is she supposed to say yes? You have to always say the truth. By the way, according to Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, you should always say the truth. And he argues that, yes, this Polish woman should say that, yes, I'm hiding the Jews and here they are. Otherwise, she is an immoral person, according to Immanuel Kant. So there are obviously different opinions about whether you should say the truth or not. The Torah is giving us not only the laws, but also the hierarchy of these laws. And that's what we get primarily from these discussions about the laws. We mentioned elections, political issues. I've got news for you. 99% of people, regardless of their political affiliation, believe in the same values. But they are arguing tooth and nail. Why are they arguing? Because they believe in the same values. The question is the differences in the priority of these values. Obviously, if we have open borders, bad people can sneak into the country through these open borders. Everybody will agree with that. Everybody will agree also that we as a country have been built on accepting immigrants. We are all here, sitting here, children of immigrants. So everybody agrees with both of these points. The question is, which idea is more prevalent in your mind? Do we believe that we need to shut down the border because of the bad people that might come in? Or do we believe that we could risk letting bad people in with having open borders? So which idea in your mind is more important? That's what makes you conservative, liberal, in every respect. It doesn't really, really, really matter. So people usually have the same ideas and same values. People have different hierarchy of these ideas. People have different hierarchy of these values. And that's exactly what Talmud is laying out to us. And that's why just studying the code of Jewish law that tells me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, every single law is not going to help me, because it doesn't tell me how do these laws intertwine and which one is supposed to be more prevalent in which case. So this is the first and the second reason why we learn the Talmud, because it gives me the understanding of laws, it gives me understanding of hierarchy of these laws. Then there's a third reason. I cannot possibly learn the laws that will pertain to every life situation in my entire day. It's impossible. Talmud will be not 63 volumes, Talmud will be 6,300 volumes. So why is therefore I need to learn Talmud? Because not only do I learn the laws, I learn how God wants me to think. The pattern of thinking. The application of the principles of how these laws are being derived. So then when I'm stuck in a situation where I don't remember the exact law, I can figure out just because I know how the Torah wants me to look at things. And then there's another reason. Number four, learning the Torah is a mitzvah. It's part of my service of God. When you will walk over to a person on the street, walk over to a non-Jewish person on the street and ask him, how do you serve God? He'll probably tell you, I serve God by praying. I serve God by helping others. I serve God by giving charity, right? How many people tell you, I serve God by studying? So you serve God by studying? Yeah, but in Judaism, studying the Torah is part of my service to God. Why? Because it's a mitzvah. God wants me to study His Torah. God wants me to understand the way He thinks. Just like if you want to create a relationship with somebody, your husband, your wife, your children, what is the main thing you want to do? You want to understand them. Parents have their children growing up, and now my son is a teenager, and I just don't get him. I don't understand how he thinks, and that bothers parents to no end. Because if somebody is dear to you, you want to understand his thought process. You want to understand how he is looking at the world around him. What is the main focal idea of Judaism? Creating a relationship with God. This is what all Judaism is about. Judaism is not about Jewish laws. Judaism is not about Jewish observances, Jewish rituals. Now, I've got news for you. In order to create a relationship with God, you have to observe Jewish laws. If you want to create a relationship with another person, you have to do what this person likes. There's no any other way of doing it. You cannot create a relationship with other person by doing things he despises. I know you hate red color. I'm going to paint the entire house in red color. I'm looking for love. No, if this person likes green color and you want to please him, you want to have a relationship with him, paint your house in green color. The only way to create a relationship with somebody is by doing what this person wants. The only way to create a relationship with God is by doing what God wants. But Judaism is not about doing what God wants. Judaism is about creating a relationship with God. And because of that, you need to be doing what God wants. So if I'm looking to create a relationship with God, what do I need to do? God says, I want to have a relationship with you also. I want you to understand me. If your spouse doesn't understand you, it bothers you. I hope. God says, I want you to understand me. If we don't understand God, it bothers him. That's why he has a mitzvah to study Torah. And then, another important reason for studying the Torah. You know, sometimes you talk to somebody and you realize they're not here, they're somewhere else. You're talking to the walls. You know, in Israel, it's a custom before you get married, you go to pray at the Western Wall. You know why? You are practicing talking to walls. So you sometimes talk to somebody and they are not there. Why? Because a person is not necessarily where his body is. A person is always where his thoughts are. Sometimes his thoughts are here, and you are talking to him here. Sometimes his thoughts are elsewhere, and you're talking to him, but he's not even paying attention. I am always consumed by whatever I'm thinking about. So, if I am thinking about a ball game, the Super Bowl coming up, I heard, right? If I'm thinking about Super Bowl, I'm there. I'm not here. I'm at the Super Bowl. I just happen to be here. My body is here. But really, I'm at the Super Bowl. If I'm thinking about my business, I'm sitting right now talking with my client in my head. If I am thinking about the Torah, if I'm thinking about the Jewish law, that's where I am. I'm consumed by it. I'm there. I'm not here. Then there's another detail about my ability to think. If I am thinking about something or someone, about an idea, this idea now is living in my head. You know, Rabbi Tversky, the famous psychiatrist, was saying that every person in your life takes up some real estate in your head. So there are some people who do nice things to you, and they deserve to take up some real estate in your head because they pay for it. They pay rent. They do you a favor, you think about them, they pay rent, and you keep them as a tenant in your head. And then there are some people who did terrible things to you, and you keep thinking about them. So Rabbi Tversky says, these guys are not paying your rent. They are squatters. They're sitting in your head for free. Rabbi Tversky says, kick out those squatters. They're not paying your rent. Don't think about people who are doing bad things to you. This is what he speaks about, people who you keep having grudge on, who you keep being angry about. So whoever or whatever you think about is living inside your head. So here is a phenomenal thing. If I'm thinking about something, I am consumed by the idea I'm thinking about, and this idea is consumed by me. This is why my ability to think about something, my intellectual capacity, is allowing me to unite with something in a fashion than nothing else would possibly allow me to unite with something. If I love you and I want to unite with you, I cannot do it because me is me and you is you. I take up this space, I cannot unite with you. I cannot sit in your chair, you cannot sit in my chair. But if I'm thinking about something, it allows me to unite with it. This is why, by the way, the Torah says, when it's talking about intimate relationships between Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, it says, and Adam knew Chava. Adam knew Eve. What do you mean knew? I understand Torah wouldn't use a vulgar language, but Torah could have used different metaphor when speaking about intimate relationships. He's specifically saying knew because knowledge is the greatest union between two things. And that's what God is trying to say in Chumash, in five books of Moses, that Adam and Eve had the greatest union one can imagine. So, when I learn the Talmud, I am uniting with God's wisdom. And this is the main reason why we learn Talmud. You see, if I just learn the code of Jewish law, it's just a list of rules, it doesn't preoccupy my intellectual capacity entirely. I need to memorize things, I need to understand things, but it doesn't make me toil, it doesn't make me ponder, it doesn't make me debate things inside my head. Talmud does exactly that. So it allows me to unite with God. And this is the main reason why we study the Talmud. This is the main reason why we spend so much time studying the Talmud, because it allows me to unite with God. This was the first class, introductory class about Talmud. These are the key points of the class.
Lesson one, the Jewish people and the Talmud. One. The Talmud has influenced every facet of Jewish culture. Its study has been and remains a source of joy for Jewish communities worldwide. One historian suggested that the Talmud is responsible for the Jews having survived their long exile. Two, the Talmud is primarily a record of halacha, Jewish law, which covers every facet of Jewish life, thereby allowing Jews to connect with God in whatever they are doing. 3. Although the written Torah is a source of Jewish law, the vast majority of Jewish law is not explicitly recorded in it. God taught these laws orally to Moses when he gave us the entirety of the Torah at Mount Sinai. 4. In addition to laws received by Moses directly from God, the oral law contains laws that were derived by the sages from the Torah's text, as well as laws legislated by the sages over the generations. 5. The famous Jewish devotion to learning is rooted in the tremendous spiritual significance attributed to Torah study, to the extent that it is considered one of the three pillars on which the world stands. Although most Jews are not lawyers or judges, the study of Talmud, Jewish law, occupies a large portion of traditional Jewish study. 6. Jews view the study of law as a mode of religious worship because the laws are the will and wisdom of God. When we absorb Torah law with our minds, we are bonding with a sliver of the divine mind. 7. When we study a Torah law on a given subject, we bring the divine wisdom contained in that law into contact with that subject. And since Jewish law's scope is so broad and that it encompasses every facet of our lives, studying halacha brings holiness into every facet of our lives.
So thank you very much. This was the first class. We just saw the key points of today's class. And next week we're gonna get the taste of the first part of Talmud, Mishnah. We're going to be actually studying it, analyzing it, and seeing how it's written, which is going to be fascinating.